I would just ask those who question the sincerity or the legitimacy of protests and vigils and expressions of outrage, who somehow label those expressions of outrage as quote-unquote political correctness, I just ask folks to step back and think, what if this happened to somebody in your family? How would you feel? To be concerned about these issues is not political correctness. It's just being American and wanting to live up to our best and highest ideals. And it's to recognize the reality that we've got some tough history and we haven't gotten through all of that history yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm white. And by and large, that really doesn't mean anything. And especially with respect to this show, it really shouldn't mean anything. It shouldn't matter what I look like back here. It shouldn't. Shouldn't really matter what color anybody is. I have been resistant to going on camera to do the show for a little while. But we are trying to find ways, trying to work it out right now, to get me on camera. And the reason why I've been so reluctant is not because I'm white. I'm not proud to be white, but I'm not ashamed to be white. It's really one of those things that I don't think about. And that's the absolute essence of white privilege. I don't have to think about when I wake up in the morning how the color of my skin is going to affect my day. I don't have to sit up straight in my car when I roll by a police officer and hope that he doesn't pull me over or kill me for a busted taillight or bust my taillight and kill me anyway. I don't have to worry about any of those things. And my race on this show has never really mattered, and I suppose it doesn't matter now, but I am going to discuss a lot of issues that African Americans have to deal with in this particular episode. And this should be highly entertaining because I am not African American, but I've done my absolute best to try to understand what it's like, although I know that I will never, ever be able to fully empathize. But to everyone out there, to my white brothers and sisters, I want to try to explain this to you. To my African-American brothers and sisters, I hear you. And to everybody else, isn't it BS that we have to discuss this stuff in the year 2016? Let's roll. Ladies and gentlemen, the Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 167. My name is Melvin. This is the show that I do every week. Hello, thank you so much for being here. Let's get started. So there's an article over at ProPublica, written by Nicole Hannah-Jones, and it's titled, Yes, Black America Fears the Police. Here's why. And they open up, she opens up with a story. She talks about how her and some friends are walking down a boardwalk. And they're just talking amongst each other. And then two girls come walking towards their group. And the girls are walking really, really fast. And one of the girls that's walking past this group whispers as they go by, run, he's got a gun. And nobody really responds, and they just kind of look around, and then they see a man walking down the boardwalk with a gun, and everybody begins running for their lives. Now, the small group that I'm referring to, the group that Nicole belongs to, there's one white girl in that group, and her name is Hunter. After the man has disappeared and they feel like they are safe, she gets on the phone. And everyone else in the group just starts looking at each other and they go, excuse me, something pretty serious going on right now. There, why are you calling relatives or friends or whoever the hell you're on the phone with? By the way, who are you on the phone with, Hunter? And she says, I'm calling the police. And there's this puzzled look that everybody shares with one another where there's this unspoken moment where they go, you know what? It never even occurred to us. So Hunter's on the phone with the police and she begins describing the situation. She gets off the phone with the police and they call back. She answers some more questions. She gets off the phone with the police and they call back. By about the fourth time they call back, they say, we're not really sure whether we should believe you or not because there seems to be some inconsistencies in the way that you're telling your story. And sure, maybe there are some inconsistencies in her story because she's freaked out. Everybody's freaked out. Some guy was just roaming around with a gun and everybody began fearing for their lives. But then after the fourth time Hunter gets off the phone with the police, she says, I think I get it. Why you don't call the police? This, according to the article, was before Michael Brown, before police killed John Crawford III for carrying a BB gun into a Walmart or before 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed in a Cleveland park, before Akai Gurley was killed by an officer while walking in a dark staircase, and before Eric Garner was choked to death for selling Lucy's, loose cigarettes. Quote, for those of you reading this who may not be black or perhaps Latino, this is my chance to tell you that a substantial portion of your fellow citizens in the United States of America have little expectation of being treated fairly by the law or receiving justice. It's possible that this will come as a surprise to you, but to a very real extent, you have grown up in a very different country than I have. As Khalil Gibran Muhammad, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, puts it, white people, by and large, do not know what it's like to be occupied by a police force. They don't understand it because it's not the type of policing that they experience, because they are treated like individuals. They believe that if I am not breaking the law, I will not be abused. Among the chants of Black Lives Matter right now, many white Americans seem shocked by the gaping divide between law enforcement and the black communities that they're supposed to serve. According to the article, she says, though, it was no surprise for us. For black Americans, policing is the most enduring aspect of the struggle for civil rights. This, according to Muhammad, a historian and director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in New York. It has always been the mechanism for racial surveillance and control. A little bit of history here. In the South, police once did the dirty work of enforcing the racial caste system. The Ku Klux Klan and law enforcement were often indistinguishable. Black and white photographs of the era memorialized the way Southern police sicked German shepherds on civil rights protesters and peeled the skin off black children with the force of water hoses. Lawmen were also involved or implicated in untold murders and beatings, killings and disappearances of black Southerners who forgot their place. They would refer to them at that time as uppity. In the North, police worked to protect white spaces by containing and controlling the rising black population that had been propelled into the industrial belt by the Great Migration. It was not unusual for Northern police to join white mobs as they attacked black homeowners attempting to move in the white neighborhoods or black workers trying to take jobs reserved for white laborers. And yet, they strictly enforced vagrancy laws, catch-alls that gave them wide discretion to stop, question, and arrest black citizens at will. Does this not sound like stop and frisk, the law that was passed in New York?
Is Black Lives Matter a hate group?
No. I mean, you mean like neo-Nazis or Aryan Nation or Klan or even terrorist groups like Boko Haram?
I wouldn't say they're terrorists. No. I think they're a hate group. They hate police officers.
Well, they have strong feelings about
them. No, they hate them. They want them dead. Pigs in a blanket is dead.
I think hate group would suggest that they have the means to commit violence, and we have not seen them involved in any violence to this point. In fact, the principal damage, I would say, is they damage themselves. Because look at this, they have no agenda.
You can be charged with a hate crime by painting a swastika on a synagogue, okay?
Yes.
These people, after the death, the murder of this deputy, went out and said, we want more police officers killed.
Over on Fox News and over on right-wing radio, it never, ever fails. And this goes for some of the local talk show hosts like Lars Larson here in Portland. It doesn't matter the situation. Whenever the police kill an unarmed black man, and that's what it is by and large, unarmed black men. Whenever that happens, you can count on it. You can set your watch to it. They are going to defend the police no matter what the situation. And they have narratives that they've come up with. They've tailored all of the recent killings of unarmed black men by police. They've tailored all of the stories so that they can just rattle them off one by one right off the top of their head and say, this is why it's okay that policeman killed that unarmed black man. And now they're trying to paint Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group. Whoa, a terrorist group. No, the NRA is a terrorist group, somebody who wants everybody to have weapons, no matter what, bar none, and as many weapons as possible. ISIS, who's carrying out the murders and calling for the murders, that's a terrorist group. A group trying to bring attention to the fact that these are unarmed black men and women who are being murdered by police. And if the police are brought upon charges, which they frequently are, up to this point, they've all gone free. And then they try this canard of all lives matter. All lives matter. That's become the right-wing call, all lives matter. If all lives matter, why don't we have a universal healthcare system? If all lives matter, why is the United States in a perpetual state of warfare? And if all lives matter, why are you on Fox News and right-wing radio defending the murder of unarmed black men and women?
When people say black lives matter, that doesn't mean blue lives don't matter. It just means all lives matter. But right now, the big concern is the fact that the data shows black folks are more vulnerable to these kinds of incidents. This isn't a matter of us comparing the value of lives. This is recognizing that there is a particular burden that is being placed on a group of our fellow citizens. And we should care about that. We can't dismiss it.
Back on St. Patty's Day, they got into a discussion on one of the shows on Fox about how Irish people used to be discriminated against. And yes, this was a thing. It's a little harder to discriminate when they're white, but, you know, they would notice mannerisms and, you know, a lot of the Irish would attend certain churches. And of course, they would have that accent. And so Irish people were heavily discriminated against. And so back on St. Patty's Day this year, Fox decided to get into a discussion of, hey, remember when white people used to be discriminated against?
I think Irish people were stereotyped and denigrated for a long time. I mean, the Kennedy brothers held this to heart forever. I think it's the root of the immigration reforms.
And the Irish got over it. They don't run around going, Irish lives matter.
The Irish got over it. They didn't go around saying that Irish lives matter. They got over it. They got over the fear, the constant fear that they had to live in, which, by the way, is the very definition of terrorism. Now, our police forces are not terrorists, but with what's happening right now in America with respect to police and the African-American community, even if they aren't killed, they are constantly harassed. All of the old jokes about walking while black, being driving while black, talking while black, laughing while black, being seen while black. There's a little bit of truth to all of that. Even if they're not being killed by police, they live in a constant state of fear. I want to tell you the story of Guthrie Ramsey. Guthrie was born in Chicago and grew up in a family that did not emphasize the obstacles that their children would face. They were African American. I was socialized to believe that the police were our friends, he said. Yet, one night, some years ago, while driving his teenage son to a soccer game, Guthrie was pulled over by police. Within minutes, he and his son were sprawled out on the ground with guns drawn on them. The police believed that Guthrie fit the description of a subject. This comes up a lot. We're stopping you because you fit the description of a subject. Guthrie, a short, easygoing guy with a contagious laugh, managed to point the police to his University of Pennsylvania faculty ID. That's right. He's an Ivy League professor and a noted musician. Quote, it was so frightening and humiliating. You get humiliated that it's so hard to get over the anger. You just don't get to experience interactions with police as garden variety circumstance. These types of stories in black communities are so ubiquitous as to be unremarkable. Quote, if my husband is running late, very late, and I cannot get a hold of him, my mind does not immediately go to foul play. I wonder if he's been detained. This fear is not unjustified. Young black men today are 21 more times likely to be shot and killed by police than white men. And clearly, this isn't all police that we're talking about, but it is too many. Nakia Jones took to the internet after one of the most recent shootings. And it's unfortunate that I even have to refer to them as that, the one of the most recent shootings. Nakia Jones is a black officer, and she did not hold back.
How dare you stand next to me in the same uniform and murder somebody? How dare you? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. So why don't we just keep it real? If you're that officer, then know good and well you got a God complex. You're afraid of people that don't look like you. You have no business in that uniform. Take it off. Take the uniform off. You have no business being a police officer. Because there's many of us that would give our life for anybody. And we took this oath and we meant it. Take the uniform off and put the KKK hoodie on. Because I will not stand for that. If you're an officer that works with me and you're wrong, I will tell you you're wrong. My heart goes out to that young man's family, because if it was my son, I don't know what I would do. But to my brothers and sisters, my juvenile brothers and sisters, I am your keeper. Put them guns down, y'all.
Philando Castile was pulled over by the police for a broken taillight. Upon the police officer approaching his car, now, Philando had a concealed carry license. He had a gun on him. He had a license for it. He was registered. But here's the thing. You have to let police know. So when the officer walked up to the car, first thing he says, and he's already nervous because he's African-American and he's being pulled over by the police. First thing he says, I have a weapon on me. It's registered. I'm trained. No, nothing to worry about. The officer says, fine. You have a concealed carry. Please get me your license. I would like to see your license and registration. When he went to reach for his license and registration, that's when all hell broke loose.
Stay with me. We got pulled over for a busted tail light in the back. And the police just, he's covered. They killed my boyfriend. He's licensed. He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet out his pocket. And he let the officer know that he had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet. And the officer just shot him in his arm. We're waiting for a backup.
I will. That's Diamond Reynolds, Philando Castile's girlfriend. She decided to live Facebook this whole thing. And she was creating a record of what was happening because it was pretty clear that what was happening was not supposed to be happening. And from there, things just continued to take a turn for the worst.
A LARPener.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand out.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot 4 bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
And just like that, Philando Castile was gone. He didn't do anything. He got pulled over for a broken taillight. And within a few minutes, he's dead. Not missing their cue, over on Fox News, right-wing radio, right-wing articles, and right-wing blogs, the narrative became this. Why is she filming this? Why isn't she helping him? Here's why. She had to create a record. Also, she could not help him. She is not an emergency room surgeon. She cannot fix him on the spot. She's his girlfriend. She's not an emergency room doctor. Plus, as you heard in the clip right there, the officer kept screaming at her to keep her hands where he could see them as she was watching his lights slowly go out. Then the Minnesota governor spoke up and said what we were already all thinking.
I'm heartbroken for Minnesota because, I've heard in the last few hours from very distinguished African-American men and women who have recounted to me how they've been pulled over, singled out, and treated very differently because of their race from how white Minnesotans expect to be covered. Would this have happened if those passengers, the driver, the passenger were white? I don't think it would have.
Alton Sterling was selling CDs outside of a bodega, and the police showed up and decided to get him on loitering. And he put up a little bit of a fight. They began to wrestle him, and once they had him on the ground, and he was of no longer a danger to anybody, they decided to kill him where he lay. The video ended up all over the internet, as it does these days, for the whole world to see. And unfortunately, the whole world includes his eldest son, a 15-year-old. Alton Sterling's girlfriend, along with his oldest child, decided to do a press conference. And you could hear the child just lose it right there into the mic.
Individuals involved in his murder took away a man with children who depended upon their daddy on a daily basis. My son is not the youngest. He is the oldest of his siblings. He is 15 years old. He had to watch this as this was put all over the outlet and everything that was possible to be shown.
His father was 38, and he should not be gone. He most certainly should not be gone for what he was doing. He most certainly should not be gone as a father to five. I am a father to three. And when I was in my early 20s, I was listening, well, I still listen to this particular artist. Her name is Ani DeFranco. And there's a line in a song where she says, "Nobody ever asked me if I could mean everything to someone." And back during that time, I really didn't mean anything to anybody. I had a few associates. I had some friends sometimes, a place to sleep, by and large, jobs off and on. I really was just floating around the world. Had I disappeared, there aren't a lot of people that would have noticed me gone. And within a couple of years, I can say with a great degree of certainty, nobody would have missed me. Fast forward to now. There are people in my life that would notice me gone. There are people that would hurt and would never get over it if anything happened to me right now at my young age. And I'm only in my mid-30s. And I do mean everything to someone. So when I hear these stories, the way I personalize them is I think, what if this was somebody that I knew? Or worse, what if this was me and it was happening in this kind of pain was being felt by all of the people that I associate with every day? They would notice me gone and it would hurt a tremendous amount. So when I hear these stories, that's the way it gets me.
In the rally audience last evening, a young lady held up a sign that read, "I wept more last night than I slept." End of quote. Colleagues, America is weeping. They are angry. They are frustrated. And Congress, and when I say Congress, I mean the Republicans in Congress, are refusing to address gun violence in America that targets black men and black women and Hispanic men and Hispanic women, and yes, even police officers. The Congressional Black Caucus is frustrated. You want to say we're mad? We're mad. We are determined to take our advocacy now to a higher level. This is our responsibility to our constituents.
That's G.K. Butterfield speaking on behalf of the Congressional Black Caucus. Finishing up from the article here, quote, "During the height of the Black Lives Matter protest, a mentally ill man shot and killed two police officers a few blocks from my home," writer of the article. "I lay up that night thinking about those two men and their families. No one wants to see people killed, not by police, not by anyone. The next morning, my husband and I took food and flowers to the grim brick precinct right around the corner from us that the officers were working out of when they were killed. The officer at the front desk did not greet us when we came in." Remember, they're black. "And he looked genuinely surprised by our offering, his face softening as he told us we didn't have to do this, but thank you. That people who should be allies somehow felt like adversaries troubled me. The next day, I drove by the precinct on the way to the store. It had been cordoned off with metal barricades. Two helmeted officers stood sentry out front, gripping big black assault rifles and watching. The message felt clear. They weren't standing out there to protect the neighborhood. They were standing there to protect themselves from us.
Don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves.
That was Malcolm X speaking in 1965. Right now, it is 2017. 16, and we are still having to deal with this. I saw pretty much after every killing of unarmed African Americans being killed by police or by other folks, I saw "say their names" trending. And I know that I don't know these people, and there's no way that I can really memorialize for them properly. I don't know who they are. I don't know their stories, but here's this. I know mine, and I know that every one of them had to have a story as deep or even deeper than the story that I have. And I saw "say their names" trending, and I said, you know what? It's the least I can do. There's an article over at the mic called 23 Everyday Actions Punishable by Death If You're Black in America. 1. Selling CDs outside of a supermarket. Alton Sterling, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, July 2016. Say his name, Alton Sterling. Selling cigarettes outside of a corner store. Eric Garner, New York City, July 2014. Eric Garner, say his name. Walking home with a friend. That's Gregory Gunn. Montgomery, Alabama, February 2016. Gregory Gunn, say his name. Samuel DeBose, missing a front license plate. Cincinnati, Ohio, July 2015. Wearing a hoodie, Trayvon Martin, Sanford, Florida, February 2012. Say his name, Trayvon Martin. Riding a commuter train, Oscar Grant III, San Francisco, California, January 2009. Oscar Grant III, say his name. Tamir Rice, holding a fake gun in a park in Cleveland, Ohio, November 2014. Tamir Rice, say his name, 12 years old. John Crawford III, Dayton, Ohio, August 2014. Holding a fake gun in a Walmart in Ohio. Then there's also holding a fake gun in Virginia. That's India M. Beatty, February 2016. India M. Beatty, holding a fake gun in Washington, D.C. Now, this was a tough one for me because for the longest time, the police refused to release this man's name. But his name is Carlos Mazzeo Funes Romero. Say his name! Carlos Mazzeo Funes Romero, Washington, D.C., January 2016. Calling for help after a car accident. Renisha McBride. Say her name. Dearborn Heights, Michigan, 2013. Driving with a broken taillight. Now, these are things the people normally should not get killed for, and yet people are being killed for them. Walter Scott, shot in the back. South Carolina, April 2015. Walter Scott, say his name. Attending a Bible study class. These folks were killed by Dylan Roof in Charleston, South Carolina, June 2015. Cynthia Marie Graham Hurd, 54. Susie Jackson, 87. Ethel Lee Lance, 70, the Payne Middleton doctor, 49, Clemente Pickney, the pastor, 41, Tywanza Sanders, 26, Daniel Simmons, 74, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, 45, Merritt Thompson, 59, say their names. Failing to signal a lane change, dead after failing to signal a lane change, Sandra Bland, Waller County, Texas, July 2015. Sandra Bland, say her name. Walking away from police. Mario Woods, San Francisco, California, December 2015. Say his name. Mario Woods, walking toward the police. Laquan McDonald, McDonald, Chicago, Illinois, October 2014. Say his name. Laquan McDonald, running to the bathroom in your apartment. Ramarley Graham, New York City, February 2012. Ramarley Graham, say her name. Walking up the stairwell of your apartment building. Akai Gurley, Brooklyn, New York. Akai Gurley, say his name. November 2014. Sitting in your car before your bachelor party. Sean Bell, Queens, New York, 2006. Sean Bell, say his name. Holding your wallet. Amadou Diallo, shot 41 times by the New York Police Department, February 1999. Making eye contact. Freddie Gray, say his name. Baltimore, Maryland, April 2015. Attending a birthday party. Jamar Clark, Minneapolis, Minnesota, November 2015. Jamar Clark, say his name. And laughing. Rekia Boyd, Chicago, Illinois, March 2012. Say her name. And even while conservatives are telling us that there is not a problem, Fox has no problem finding African Americans to bring on Fox News to tell them, hey, remember, the Republicans are trying to protect you. It's not those leftists.
Bernie and Hillary, just like Barack Obama and every Democrat before them, has done nothing for black people but tell them lies. And then what happens is they look at black leaders and they fight to pimp out the black vote. So they're jockeying now, Bernie and Hillary.
Right.
They're fawning all over the black leaders and they're trying to get black people to tell us, like we're dummies, hey, black people, vote for these Democrats who aren't going to do anything for you. And the cycle keeps repeating itself. I've always said Republicans right. need to go out there and ask for the black vote because blacks should no more vote for Hillary or Bernie than they should the Grand Wizard of the KKK, because they keep giving us all these bad policies. And last night, you know what they should have said, Brian? Hey, black people, stop having 72% of your babies out of wedlock, and your kids won't be massively incarcerated and arrested.
Sometimes they want to say horribly racist things on Fox News, but realize if it came out of their white mouths, it might look bad. So they can always find somebody. There's a handful of them African Americans that are willing to go on television and disparage other African Americans. And is it any wonder, with the rise of Trump, with the rise of authoritarianism, with politicians, right-wing politicians, openly practicing racism in public, Fox News, right-wing radio, right-wing blogs, right-wing news sites constantly pushing absolute, outright, unabashed racism. Is it any wonder that after 150 years, the KKK is finally seeing a climate where they can again come to prominence? This from the LA Times. This year marks 150 years of existence, and the Klan is trying to reshape itself for a new era. Some independent Klan organizations say they are merging with other hate groups in order to build strength. Quote, we will work on a unified Klan or alliance this summer, talking about right now, said Brent Waller, Imperial Wizard of the United Dixie White Knights of Mississippi. In a series of interviews with the Associated Press, Klan leaders said that they feel U.S. politics are going their way as a nationalist, us against them mentality deepens across the nation, stopping or limiting immigration, a desire of the Klan dating back to the 1920s. All these calls for stop immigration, blame the brown people, it's those other folks. That kind of thing feeds the Klan's dreams. And for them, this is more of a cause than ever. Leaders say membership has gone up at the twilight of President Obama's second term of office, though few would provide actual numbers. Joining the Klan is as easy as this. Filling out an online form, provided you're white and Christian. You have to be white and Christian. And by the way, why don't more white Christians speak out against the Klan? Members can visit the online store and buy one of the Klan's trademark white cotton robes for $145. Or, if you want, you can splurge, spend $165 on the satin version.
A group many call white supremacists have a conference planned for this weekend to talk about the man they say has energized their movement, Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. The group has rented out the Ronald Reagan building downtown for their event, and that's where we find Garrett Hake, who sat down tonight with the event's organizer for an exclusive interview. And Garrett, what did he tell you?
Well, Leslie, the event organizer told me he's got about 150 people registered for this event at the Reagan Building Rotunda behind me, where they will enjoy dinner and cocktails and discussion of how the Republican presidential frontrunner could help the white nationalist cause. The National Policy Institute promotes Saturday's conference in D.C. with a slick web video that asks a provocative question. Is Donald Trump a white nationalist?
Is he a racially conscious person? I don't know, and I actually think probably no, due in some ways to his age. I think a lot of older Americans, they're implicitly white. They just when they think of America, it's a white country.
The Southern Poverty Law Center describes NPI's president, Richard Spencer, as a suit-and-tie white supremacist, his think tank a white nationalist organization. In the Republican frontrunner, Spencer sees a potential ally in the White House.
He's fighting for us. He's saying we're going to be great again. We're going to win again. And there's this implicit identity to this. There's this implicit nationalism.
Quoting from the article here, while today's Klan is still involved in atrocities, there's no way that it is as violent as the Klan of the 1960s, said Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, an advocacy group that tracks activity by groups it considers to be extremist. That does not mean that it is some benign group that does not engage in political violence, though, he added. The Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish protection group that monitors Klan activity, describes the Loyal White Knights as the most active Klan group today, but estimates that it has no more than 200 members total. The ADL puts total Klan membership nationwide at around 3,000. The Alabama-based Southern Poverty Law Center says there's no evidence that the Klan is returning to the strength of its heyday. It estimates that the Klan has about 190 chapters nationally with no more than 6,000 members total, which would be a mere shadow of the estimated 2 to 5 million members in the 1920s. But here's the thing, America. They will tell you. The Southern Poverty Law Center will tell you. Klan groups will tell you. The president himself, the White House, will tell you that these groups have become larger, more powerful, and more venomous ever since we've gotten a black president. And it's not because our president has been pushing any sort of racism, because he hasn't. Right wingers will tell you that he has, but he hasn't. But they see him in the White House, and it's right there, a black man in the White House, and they lose their minds. And it sets the stage for right-wing politicians to go, look at the others. It's not the trade deals that are taking your jobs away. It's those people. It's that guy in the White House. It's those people coming over the border. It's those people that wear headscarves. It's those people with long beards. It's those people that have a religion that is not your religion. It's the others. It's them. It's not us, the policymakers. And this kind of open racism has made longtime racists feel like this is their time to come out of the closet. I want you to meet Rick Tyler.
Hi, I'm Kelly McCarthy from WRCB Channel 3 News. I'm here now with Rick Tyler, congressional candidate. Rick Tyler is the man behind the Make America White Again campaigns.
When I designed the Make America White Again billboard, it was specifically to engender in people's minds a thought process that would take them back to, let's say, the 1960s. I call it the Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet, Mayberry America. And some might call it the Norman Rockwell America. I and many, many, many millions of others believe that that was a better America. We believe that it was an America where you didn't have to lock your doors, you didn't have to worry about carjackings and home invasions, you didn't have to worry about Muslim sleeper cells down the street, you didn't have to worry about Islamic mosques radicalizing people. It was an America that was far superior to the America that we live in today, and not coincidentally, it was an America whose demographic was 85% plus Caucasian.
It's awful that African Americans are being killed by police without much in the way of consequence. And the answer is not, let me repeat, the answer is not to shoot back. I understand that's a popular argument, that's even a popular hashtag, but the answer is not to shoot back. But one man who this show will not name decided down in Texas to shoot back. At a Black Lives Matter protest, 12 police officers were shot. Five, at this point, have died. And they were shot by a black man who was upset about some of the recent murders. Let me be clear. Racism is awful no matter which way it works. But here we are. And so we've got two things going on right now. The rise of racism in America, which has largely been turned on African Americans, but could very easily be turned back on white Americans. And the ease in which you can get a gun, whether you're a terrorist or whether you are racially motivated to kill somebody from the race that you do not like, it's really, really easy to get a weapon. And what we've been told up to this point is, hey, the more guns, the safer that we are. In the Pulse shooting, they said, hey, had there been more guns out there, instead of 50 dead, you would have had 300 or 400 dead. And by the way, there was a good guy with a gun at the Pulse. And he got into a shootout with the shooter and ended up outside because he himself did not want to be killed. There are five arguments about gun control that are dead wrong. The first one, this from the LA Times. A good guy with a gun could have stopped it. At this shooting in Texas, there were, and remember, Texas is an open carry state. at this shooting in Texas where these five officers were killed, there were about a dozen folks in the audience who were open carrying with their big guns slung over their shoulders. And you know what happened when the shots rang out? They ran like hell. This argument needs to die. Quote, most armed citizens fare worse than their police counterparts. In an independent study commissioned by the National Gun Victims Association Council, researchers put 77 participants in varying levels of firearms training through three realistic self-defense scenarios. In the first, seven of the participants shot an innocent bystander. Almost all of the participants in the first and second scenarios who engaged the bad guy were killed. In the final scenario, 23% of participants fired at a suspect who didn't actually pose a threat. Overwhelming empirical evidence corroborates the simulation. Of the 160 active shooting incidents identified by the FBI from 2000 to 2013, only one was stopped by an armed civilian. In comparison, two were stopped by off-duty police, four by armed guards, and 21 by unarmed civilians. Shooters love gun-free zones. This is about the dumbest one, because remember, the NRA headquarters and the RNC convention are both going to be gun-free zones. If we examine the 33 public mass shootings in which four or more people were killed between January 2009 and June 2014, the evidence reveals that 18 occurred in areas where guns were not banned or had armed security present. The clear pattern that emerges from these incidents is that shooters have a personal connection to their locations, not some grudge against them, no matter how misguided. And when shooters choose a place at random, there's no substantive evidence that they gravitate specifically toward gun-free zones. The Aurora, Colorado shooter, for example, left a diary spelling out his motivation and plans for the attack, in which he appeared far more concerned about finding a good parking spot than facing resistance. In Orlando, the shooter clearly knew he was going to be facing armed resistance, and he was a regular customer of the Pulse and even tried to purchase body armor with his firearms. Quote, no laws could have prevented this tragedy. Here's another dumb one. After a string of bombings, our Congress decided to start clamping down on bomb-making material. Since that has happened, terrorists have moved away from bombs and have moved towards what? Guns. Al-Qaeda and ISIS has said very openly, America is awash in guns. Just go into America, get yourself a gun, and kill as many people as possible. It's so easy to get a gun. Or how about this dumb argument? Terrorists and criminals aren't deterred by laws. Applying this logic, why have any laws? If criminals are just going to run red lights, why have traffic penalties? The NRA's reasoning is a prescription for chaos, and it doesn't withstand contact with empirical reality. There's clear evidence that laws do influence criminal behavior. Here's what I was talking about a minute ago. One study, for instance, found that over the past two decades, terrorists in the U.S. have largely abandoned bombs. Why? One reason is that in the aftermath of the 1995 Oklahoma City bomb, and federal legislation made it more difficult for consumers to obtain bomb-making ingredients and easier for law enforcement to monitor those purchases. By the way, we make a lot of these guns here in America. This new oversight led terrorists to revamp their tactics, replacing bombs with guns. An investigation by The Trace revealed 95% of terrorism deaths in the U.S. between January 2002 and August 2015 were caused by firearms. But wait a minute! Guns are just a tool! Guns don't kill people! People kill people! Fine. Guns are just a tool, right? Just like guns and hammers. Here's the rather obvious problem with such thinking. Firearms are far more lethal than knives, machetes, and hammers. Gunshot wounds frequently cause catastrophic damage, and the ability to maintain a quick and steady rate of fire allows a gunman maximum casualties. There's a reason that American mass killers choose assault-style rifles to carry out their attacks and not knives or hammers. Picture this. December 14, 2012. A man wielding a knife assaulted people at a school in China, stabbing 23 children and one adult. Hours later, a man armed with an AR-15 attacked an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, shooting 20 students and 8 adults. At Sandy Hook, all 20 children and 6 of the adults died. In China, there wasn't a single fatality. The gun made all the difference, and it happened on the same day.
I love the poorly educated.
The 1996 Dickey Amendment made it impossible for the CDC to spend any money tracking gun deaths. With that, there's a lot of outside groups, news organizations that still try to track these things. And the CDC still does its best. There's an article over at the Washington Post that says more police officers die on the job in states that have more guns. If more guns makes us safer, and they really want to say all lives matter, and more specifically, conservatives, you want to say the blue lives matter, well, officers more often are killed in the states that have more guns. If you're really concerned, because clearly you're not concerned about African Americans, so if you really are concerned about the police, then you should want fewer guns. The study, published in the American Journal of Public Health, used FBI data to track police officer deaths in the line of duty from 1996 to 2010. They cross-referenced this with state-level gun ownership rates as measured by the CDC and Prevention Survey. They asked about gun ownership from 2001 to 2004 to isolate as accurately as possible the effects of gun ownership on police officer homicides. They correlated for a number of factors that could also affect police homicide rates: overall rates of violent and property crime, the racial and economic demographics in different states, income, education, alcohol consumption, and rural and urban population breakdowns. Quote, higher levels of private firearm ownership likely increase the frequency with which officers face potentially life-threatening situations on the job, the study says. High rates of officer homicides appear to be caused by more frequently encountering situations where privately owned firearms were present, it says.
Here on GunBroker.com is the 9mm gun that George Zimmerman tells us he used to shoot and kill Trayvon Martin on February 26, 2012. He says it will be put up for auction on Thursday. These pictures posted on Zimmerman's auction page are photos of the gun from the trial. We talked to Zimmerman via phone about the weapon. We asked Zimmerman why he decided to sell it.
And I thought it's time to move past the firearm. And if I sell it and it sells, I move past it. Otherwise, it's going in a safe for my grandkids and never to be, you know, used or seen again. What I've decided to do is not cower. I'm a free American, and I can do what I'd like with my possessions.
That's George Zimmerman, the scumbag that killed Trayvon Martin. And for those of you that say that it was not racially motivated, he had called 911 more than 100 times in the past year or two before killing Trayvon Martin and was always complaining about the African Americans in his neighborhood. And after he was exonerated for murder, after it was found that it was justified that he killed Trayvon Martin, he decided to paint a Confederate flag and it sold for thousands of dollars. Why would he do that? White power. The ubiquitousness of guns, the quite easily accessible to anybody who wants them. And rising racial tensions in America created this perfect storm. But he doesn't believe that race is the problem. He believes that the problem is that you liberals are just trying to take his guns.
The man who killed Trayvon Martin should have never had a gun in the first place.
She made comments that I should not have had a gun, which legally nothing stopped me nor stops me currently from owning or possessing a firearm.
Most of the mass killings are carried out by use of an AR-15. This from Reuters. The family of the now deceased inventor of the AR-15 rifle spoke out recently against civilian use of the weapon. Our father, Eugene Stoner, designed the AR-15 and subsequent M16 as a military weapon to give our soldiers an advantage over the AK-47, the Stoner family said. He died long before any of the mass shootings occurred, but we do think that he would be horrified and sickened as anyone, if not more, by these events. Members of the families asked for individual anonymity, but said that as a group, he was an avid sportsman, hunter, and skeet shooter. They said he neither used his creation for sport nor kept it for his personal defense. He never, ever owned one, they said. But there's an argument that everybody in America should get to own one and own as many of them as they would like. And our Congress has no problem doing whatever the NRA tells them to do. And I've been to gun clubs before. I've been out shooting. And what happens inside the halls of those gun clubs? A lot of it is racial. Now, perhaps when I decided to go while Obama was president, maybe that's what made it racial. Perhaps had I gone in there when George W. Bush was president, I wouldn't have heard so much racist stuff. But I went in there shooting when Obama was president, so I got to hear tons and tons of racist crap. And those are your NRA members. Not all of them are racist, but plenty of them are. And the NRA owns your Congress, and Mitch McConnell recently went on Fox News and said so very explicitly. We are owned by the NRA. We do what the NRA tells us to do.
So final question, just to make it clear. You're saying no consideration of Judge Garland by this Congress, even if Hillary Clinton wins the election. No consideration by this Congress. You're going to stand firm on that, even in a lame duck session.
Yeah, I can't imagine that a Republican majority in the United States Senate would want to confirm in a lame duck session a nominee opposed by the National Rifle Association.
Just like that. The NRA is a group driven not by the Constitution, not by the Second Amendment, not by safety, not by making America safe, not by making us more harmonious. They are a profit-driven group. And they know that there are a lot of racists inside their group.
The NRA right now, effectively owns the House of Representatives and a significant degree of the United States Senate. And until the American public clears some of those people out that aren't voting with their constituents and listening to the gun lobby instead, it's going to be hard to get change.
And they're going to use that to their advantage in a time when we have all of this rising racism, in a time where everybody is scared of everybody. You're scared of your neighbor, scared of the guy next to you on the bus, scared of people that look different from you, scared of people that are a different religion from you. And the NRA says, you know, the way to protect yourself is to kill them when you feel threatened. In Dallas, where the five officers were killed, the Dallas police chief decided to speak up about this subject. And he had to do so very, very carefully because of gun nuts, because of the NRA, and because he himself is African American. So his words can be taken any number of different ways. And he was asked, hey, does the accessibility of guns, does the fact that anybody, anytime, anywhere, just many guns as they want, has that made things safer around here?
It's a little different here in Texas in the way we view open carry, concealed carry. And we've had great dialogue with our state legislators about this. And we've expressed all of our concerns, and we're trying as best we can as a law enforcement community to make it work so the citizen can express their Second Amendment rights. But it's increasingly challenging when people have AR-15 slung over and shootings occur in a crowd and they begin running, and we don't know if they're the shooter or not, or they begin, has been the presumption that a good guy with a gun is the best way to resolve some of these things. Well, we don't know who the good guy is versus who the bad guy is if everybody starts shooting.
I grew up in some pretty tough neighborhoods, and I grew up listening to a lot of hip-hop music. And it was not uncommon to hear rappers absolutely unloading on police. And one of those rappers that I would hear frequently disparage police officers was Snoop Doggy Dogg. Well, he goes by Snoop Dogg now. And we've reached a point in our nation's history where some of us have grown up. And I'm not going to say that Snoop trusts the police necessarily, but after what's been happening recently with racism in America and what's been happening to both police and people who are being apprehended by police, Snoop decided to come out and say, we are with you, LAPD. We are going to work together with you because we are all in this together.
So today was the first step to many steps. We are here to show love and support to the police force in Los Angeles and get some understanding and some communication. And we feel like this is a great start. We want to thank them for letting us come into this situation today. We didn't know that we were going to be graduating students, but this is even better because now these students that are about to hit the streets can know that there is some sort of dialogue going on, and they don't have to be fearful, and they can do their jobs and know that when you stop somebody, you're a conversation away from sending them home or taking them to jail, but the conversation is key. So thank y'all for allowing us to have conversation, and we love y'all. I appreciate it.
The man who filmed Eric Garner's death by a cop's chokehold, his name is Ramsey Orta. And in the year since filming and releasing that video, which eventually led to a lot of animus towards police, Ramsey Orta recently reported to his 4-year prison term. Since he filmed that and released it, he has been horribly harassed by police over and over and over again about every teeny tiny thing they could find on him as soon as they found out who he was. And he believes that even though he's only going to prison for 4 years and he's a young man, he believes that he is going to die in prison. Holy hell no. This is not the way that it should be happening. Police should not be targeting African Americans. African Americans should not be targeting police. People should not be killed when they go to elementary school. They should not be killed when they go to see a movie. They should not be killed when they go to college. They should not be killed for walking down the street. They should not be killed for driving in their car. They should not be killed because they got a broken taillight out. They should not be killed because they make eye contact with police. They should not be killed because they're walking while black, driving while black, talking while black. Nobody should be killed for such stupid, stupid things. Excuse me. And while I lose my freaking mind on this mic, I'd like to hand it over to somebody who's a little more calm than Melvin is. His name is Kellen Nixon, and he was in Dallas when the five police were killed. He was one of the folks that was in the audience as a part of the Black Lives Matter protest. And he recently went on MSNBC and granted them an interview to give them an inside on what it looked like inside of the audience. But what was striking to me about his interview was the way he chose to end it. After it was over, he decided to give a shout out to individual people, his girlfriend, kids, things of that nature. Then he said this.
And I just want to say this last thing. A lot of people want me to hate. A lot of people want me to come on and hate. They want me to say kill, kill, kill. I've been getting these messages on social media. But I just want to continue to spread the message of love. I want to continue to tell us to love one another, to love your neighbor as yourself, to love in the traffic, to love on your job, to love on social media. Everywhere you can, love. We got to make our love louder than their hate. And that's the only way that we're going to have any kind of change. Well, and I thank you guys for having me on.
Part of what's driving the racism right now is the fact that it's a presidential year. The fact that we've had for 8 years racists attacking our president, quite honestly, for nothing more than being black. The fact that we have a white nationalist running for president right now who's using a lot of racist language. The fact that on Fox News and right-wing radio, blogs and news sites and all the rest, they have no problem defending the murder of African Americans. And yeah, that's a problem. And this country has a deep, dark history of racism. And now a whole lot of that racism seems to have returned. But the difference now is that we have more guns in this country than we have people. And in all of those guns is a lot of high-capacity magazines. And it seems like it's a powder keg that's about to go. But even with that, there are voices. There are voices like Kellen Nixon. There are voices like mine. There are voices like the survivors of those who were killed, the unarmed people that were killed by police. Their survivors are saying, don't do this. Don't carry out more violence. That's not the way such and such person would have wanted it to be. That's not the way Eric Garner would have wanted it to be. That's not the way Philando Castile would have wanted it to be. That's not the way Tamir Rice would have wanted it to be. That's not the way any of these folks would have wanted it to be. Even in all this darkness, we have to find a way to drive out the demons. We have to find a way to drive out the hate. And we're not going to drive out hate with more hate. We have to find a way to come together and be able to openly discuss these issues. Not pretend like they're not happening. Not pretend like unarmed black people aren't being killed by police, because they are. And that begins with a conversation. Not talking points. With a conversation. And an honest conversation. Now, I'm not saying bring everybody down the next time you get into a room and you've got people around you, start bringing them down with statistics and terrible stories. But if you get the chance, bring it up. Have a public discussion about it, because none of this is going to change without a public dialogue. And don't use talking points. Talk from your heart, and don't talk in terms of race. Just say, this is wrong. This doesn't need to be happening. And we are here. We're all in this together, and we can and will do something about this. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. And we, of course, are still on Kiwi Station. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or at Podbean or on Kiwi Station. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. Suppose you could punch in Melvin. It might come up. I don't know. You could also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us here at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. Still, feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Reject an austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. Say their names. This is Melvin, signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.